thought has wings, and lots of things are seldom what they seem.
Sometimes you think you've lived before all that you live today.
Things you do come back to you as though they knew the way.
Oh, the tricks your mind can play.
It seems we stood and we talked like this,
just like this,
once before,
once before.
We looked at each other in the same way then, but I can't remember where or when.
That's right, I can't remember, darling, when.
The clothes you're wearing are the clothes that you wore,
that you wore.
The smile you're smiling, you were smiling then. I can't remember where or when.
From somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
You know, no matter where you go, one of the hot topics of discussion, the creation of the planet Earth, lots of things going on. Some people believe it's 6,000 years old. Others say, as I believe, it's 4.5 billion years old. In a moment, our guest, Dr. Brooks Agnew, first-time guest to Coast to Coast AM, his book, The Ark of Millions of Years. Get ready for this one on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Brooks Agnew spent most of his youth hanging around Caltech and the folks who co-opted Jet Propulsion Labs. He entered the Air Force in 1973, where he became an electronics engineer. After earning an honorable discharge, he attended Brigham Young, Western Kentucky, Tennessee Technological Universities. He has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, a master's degree in statistics, a Ph.D. in physics. He has published more than 100 articles and papers on subjects ranging from radiation to trans-dimensional movement through space-time. He was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HARP, Holes in Heaven. He also teaches mathematics at Gaston College in North Carolina. Dr. Agnew has recently co-authored a landmark publication on the creation of the Earth, The Ark of Millions of Years. The theoretical physics he presents in the book may ignite the torches of the Nobels as a breakthrough in wormhole mechanics. He's our guest on Coast to Coast. Hello, Dr. Brooks Agnew. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. How are you?
Good. Good to talk with you. Any relation to the late vice president?
No, I don't think so. I think his name was a change from something Italian or Greek.
Yeah, it is a different name, indeed. Hey, tell me, how did you tie in your very heavy science background with some of the things that I read in your book, which I think are just fantastic, which really bounders on creation?
Well, as you go through life trying to discover things, especially mathematics and physics, everybody reaches an impasse. Either you reach the end of all known knowledge, which these days is becoming more and more difficult, if not impossible, to do with our age of information access, or you reach the limit of your ability to learn. And somewhere in that impasse, you sort of stretch your heart out or your soul out to reach for an answer. And if your passion to know that answer still exists, your soul sort of opens up and pure knowledge is poured into it. And as I read the histories of great mathematicians or great physicists, this is, in fact, the way that they break through from one realm of the known into the unknown and making it known for us. So that's exactly what happened to me. As I grew up in life. I had a religious background, and I reached a point in that where I thought, gee, this is nonsense. I'm going to learn mathematics and physics, and I poured myself into that. And then about 20, 25 years later, I reached an impasse with that, and I said, gee, you know, something's missing here.
Maybe a mix, right?
Yeah. So I was actually giving a lecture one day on the speed of light, and when I finished the lecture, my co-author approached me and said, gee, I've got a great idea for a book, but it needs a physics point of view to round it out. And so we collaborated, and it was like a tremendous light went off, and all the pieces fit together, and we began writing, and 2 years later it was done.
The title of your book is called The Arc of Millions of Years. What does that mean?
Well, in ancient history, back in records known as the Zohar, they talked about Noah's Ark being a great ship that sailed across the cosmic sea. And the Egyptians sort of described this cosmic sea as the rift in the Milky Way. You know, if you look up at the Milky Way, in the middle of it, there's sort of a dark, uninhabited area where there's very few stars. They call that the cosmic sea. And as the record states, when Noah arrived, he said, yes, I sailed across the cosmic sea. And so you have this name that stuck in history called the Ark of Millions of Years, or the Ship of Millions of Years. And so we sort of borrowed that name and used it as the title of the book, and we coupled it with the grand sextile astrological alignment that occurred in November of 2003, which is on the cover of the book, the six planets in the shape of the Star of David with Earth in the center. And I might add, during this particular one, there was a lunar eclipse, which had not occurred since the heralding of the birth of Solomon. So all this symbolism fell together as sort of a timely flag that this knowledge has now been restored. So we put it in the book.
That was a pretty dramatic celestial event, wasn't it, 2003?
Well, it was and it wasn't. You know, it wasn't on Fox News or the mainstream media, but if you went on the Internet and put it in, there are literally just thousands of websites claiming and describing all kinds of significance, that events on the Earth are going to change, or that signs have been given that a turn has been taken for mankind and for the existence of the Earth.
Let's go back a little bit, if we can, Brooks. There are some people who believe that Earth is 6,000 years old. That's it, 6,000 years old. And, of course, most mainstream scientists that I know believe the planet to be 4.5 billion years old. Where do you stand in this?
Well, that's the, I guess, the core of the book. We believe that the Earth is both 7,000 years old and 4.5 billion years old.
How can it be both?
Well, because there are two Earths. One Earth is a temporal Earth that took 4.5 billion years to develop in this universe. And the other is, let's call it a spiritual Earth, or a spiritually created Earth, much like the one that's described in the second creation in Genesis. And those two Earths were brought together to make this sort of living, vibrating planet upon which we live. And that event was the arrival of Noah.
Well, now that may explain the differences between the two camps.
Well, at one point, it was a gulf. I mean, insurmountable, an impassable gulf. But when we began doing the research for this book, as to the answer, you know, what about this Noah's Ark, we started to see, as we went back through one millennia after another, through ancient records, ancient observers were scientists of their day, I guess, they all made the same observation, and their symbols are all over the place. We, in the book, call it the union of the polarity. It's the construction of the Star of David. It's the construction of the Andean cross, all kinds of spirals and life forces and two-headed things and the yin and the yang. all of this pointed toward a union of a spirit earth and a temporal earth into one earth on which we live today.
That's fascinating. Okay, let's pick it up from Noah. Tell me what you believe this episode was. And, of course, the Bible has its definition, and then some other people have their own.
Right. Well, I guess you can begin in Genesis, in the first creation series. If you just read it for what it is, without interpretation, without lectern thumping or yelling or screaming or damnation, what you see is basically a water planet upon which God moved his spirit and divided the water planet into two water planets and then put heaven in between them and then separated the dry land from the water and then on the third day gave it a sun and a moon to govern its time. Well, somewhere in the two first periods of development, this did not turn into a frozen ball. It moved from where it was created to where it now exists. And what I tried to do as a physicist, cosmologically speaking, trying to figure out some mechanism by which you could move a planet from where it was created, let's say in the center of our galaxy, to where it now rests in orbit around this main sequence sun without freezing it. In other words, it's got to move in a fairly good amount of time without turning into a frozen ball, and it's got to carry Noah and all of his ancestors intact to this planet. So the answer was in spinning black holes. Now, there's been a lot of research done on this, although not directly, mathematically speaking, or through what we call perturbation theories.
You think then the entire planet, Earth, somehow went through a black hole to arrive at its present location?
Yes.
That's a fascinating thing. Now, this is a first, Brooks.
Well, see, when a black hole spins, and they all do, because they're just the, I guess, the end life cycle of a collapsing star, if you look through a solar telescope at our sun, for instance, you'll see it rotating. You'll see a sunspot traveling across the face of the sun to give you evidence that our sun is rotating on its axis. But at the end of our sun's life, when its fuel is exhausted, it will begin to cool and to shrink. And as it shrinks, by conservation of momentum, it will spin faster and faster and faster. And if our sun was large enough, say about 50 times its current mass, it would not only collapse past the supernova stage to a white dwarf, but it would continue to collapse to become a black hole. And that spinning would continue to increase. Now, if you spin it, it doesn't stay round. It sort of deforms like a tennis ball with a tremendous spin on it. It flattens out. Now, if you look at it from the edge, it looks like a ring of death. You know, it's light cannot escape it. If your planet goes into it, you're going to be tidally distended like you see in the movies. Sort of the front part of your ship is torn apart, and then the center part, and then the end part, and you're no longer recognizable. But if you look at this sort of like a large donut, and the diameter of the hole in the donut is, say, the distance across our solar system, then what you have is a center of this black hole that is tremendously warping space-time, but there's no mass in it. All the mass is in the outer ring. So a planet could pass from one point in the universe to another point in the universe, or from one universe to another universe, without being destroyed.
All right, now, are you saying that it was just Earth that did this, or our entire solar system?
Well, for the purposes of our book, we just stick with Earth.
Okay, all right.
Earth is different enough from the other planets in our solar system. Well, it's different enough from our own moon. Earth is made of primarily iron and nickel, which is pretty stable, and the moon is made of primarily aluminum and titanium. So they could not have coalesced from the same homogeneous cloud of dust.
Give me sort of, if you can, Dr. Agnew, a scientific picture, if you want to paint this for us, of what's happening. Earth is in some other section of the galaxy. It somehow finds its way into this spinning black hole. Tell us what happens then.
Well, relative to the people that are on that Earth, a short amount of time passes, a short amount of distance occurs. But relative to someone, say, outside that field, or say on the other side of the black hole, they would see a planet moving across immeasurable distances of space and time in an instant. So the beings, Noah's people, that lived on that Earth, living 800, 900, 1,000 years, then blend with sort of, if you want to call it a different phase, or if you want to call it like a water droplet swallowing up a dust ball, it blends with this temporal Earth and the race of men that are on this Earth. Now, of course, it's cataclysmic. A lot of people on both worlds are destroyed, but some survive. And then the two races and all the ecology that's with it, the animals in the sea and in the air, all have to find a new ecology. And what we see in paleobiology and paleobotany is that DNA is going along rather simple and predictable, and then all of a sudden, somewhere in the timeline, the DNA radically changes. Life becomes much more sophisticated. It makes a tremendous DNA jump, including man. We look at the DNA of man, and we've been fairly successful. Now, this isn't my area of expertise, but we have been fairly successful in mapping the gene map of man. And what we found is that 90% of the DNA that makes up a human being is unexpressed here. And nature...
90%.
Right. Nature does not develop things by its environment that aren't needed, which means that the DNA that makes up you and me was developed somewhere else.
Or else we would have been able to use up all of it. What you're saying is 10% of it may have been created here, right?
It's possible that 10% of it was created here, maybe more. But the point is that we were either developed somewhere else, which is highly likely, or we will complete our development somewhere else.
Okay, now what's the significance of the travel from one location to here?
Well, I can't explain that from a scientific standpoint, but I can from maybe ancient documents.
All right.
It is believed that the origin of the Earth was originally created at God's footstool, generally in his neighborhood, shall we say. And when it was ready, and this Earth was ready, he intelligently moved it into the black hole, or whatever mechanism he used to move it from the center of our galaxy to here.
Why even move it? Why not just keep it where it was?
Well, that's a good question, but you have to kind of look at the big picture. And I don't mean to get too spiritual here, but if we believe, and I believe many people do, that they are the literal offspring of God, then he creates an environment by which we can reach our fullest potential. And that environment here is one where our senses are very limited, and our spirit, or what makes our personality, our soul, if you will, yearns for something far beyond what we can grasp with our physical. And so it makes us grow in a way that we cannot grow in another environment. So if you will just permit me, it's because this is the design by which his children are allowed to reach their full potential, and that's why it's moved. And we're not the only world.
Okay.
There are worlds without number.
Prior to the move, then, of the planet, this fascinates me, the Earth was inhabited, right?
Yes.
Okay. Those inhabitants, what happened to them? Did they survive the travel?
Yes, many of them survived. The ones that traveled with Noah survived, and the ones that were here survived. But, of course, there were vast amounts of the civilizations that perished.
So you believe the story, the biblical story of Noah's Ark, is based primarily not of the Ark being a ship, but the Ark being the planet, if I understand you right.
Yes, the ship is actually on the planet, so the Ark may have been a literal craft, but the life that came with it, if you consider all of the genetic material, the different animals that are on this planet, the Ark would have had to have been the size of California instead of 20 million cubic feet, well, the way people have
true.
Calculated it.
And we would have found it by now then.
Yeah. So what the ancient records say is that there was a union of the polarity, that Noah and his people came here with a planet.
Stay with us. This is a fascinating theory you've come up with. Dr. Brooks Agnew, physicist, he's done it all. We'll be back in a moment.
The After Dark Newsletter. Subscribe now by calling toll-free 1-888-727-5505. Premier Radio Network presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
This is fascinating stuff with our guest, Dr. Brooks Agnew. Hey, the After Dark CD is available to you still. You get two CDs. It's a double CD package. Bumper music, unforgettable calls to the show, classic ghost stories. A couple ways you can simply pick it up. One is by going to the AfterDarkCD.com website, www.AfterDarkCD.com, or call this toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331. That's 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dr. Brooks Agnew, our guest. His website, by the way, arcofmillionsofyears.com, linked up with his name on coasttocoastam.com. Let's put Noah and the other planet aside for just a moment, Brooks, if we can, and talk about black holes. Stephen Hawking last year decided to change his views on black holes, where originally he thought if anything entered it, it would be ripped to shreds. He's not saying that anymore.
Well, I think it's kind of a simultaneous realization many physicists came to. When you think about a black hole, it's difficult to picture. So I use a balloon. We call it the balloon universe, actually.
All right.
if you take a balloon in your hand, say about the size of a basketball, and about half deflated, and you put your thumbs right and left on either side of the balloon, and you press into the center of the balloon until your thumbs touch, now what you have is...
And hopefully you don't blow up the balloon.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't blow up the universe. What you see is the effect of the gravitational distortion of space-time in a model
right
there before your
hand. Okay, that's a good picture.
So now instead of having to travel completely around the balloon or across the open space of the inside of the balloon, all you have to do is pass between the two membranes of rubber, which are squeezed between your thumbs in the center of that balloon.
And you're there.
Right.
Okay. By doing so, do you believe that there are countless numbers of these black holes, wormholes, whatever they may be, throughout the universe?
Physicists, when they do the mathematics, and I'll kind of touch a little bit on superstring theory here, we generate what we call quantum foam. Now, there are four forces in the universe: electromagnetism, the strong and weak molecular forces, and then there's gravity. Now, all the math that we've been able to do in physics up to this point does a very good job at describing the first three. But when you throw gravity into Einstein's equations or into Riemann's equations, things don't make sense. Gravity is such a weak force that you end up with answers like infinity, which we don't like to reach. So when you think about universes or dimensions, they become innumerable. They become countless. And this quantum foam, connections, as it were, between one point in the universe,
mm-hmm,
or one universe and another universe,
another one,
it becomes innumerable and almost unimaginable, unmanageable for the human mind.
These black holes, Brooks, were they created for transportation purposes? I mean, were they there so we could step from one area to another? What do you think its purpose was?
I think the purpose is that, exactly. The distances across what we can see as space, what we think is linear space, because light, we believe, travels in a straight line and hits the lens of the Hubble telescope, and we say, oh, that's so far away.
Exactly.
Possibly because of gravity and motion and the effects of all this, light doesn't travel in a straight line at all. It curves. It goes around like a continuous ball. And the distances are so daunting when you think of something like, well, let's say UFOs, and we think, gee, they must come from another planet. Well, even if they traveled at the speed of light, it would be hundreds of millions of years before any craft could travel from one side of our galaxy to our side of the galaxy to visit our little blue planet. By that time, their home world's gone, and we're so far advanced or so extinct that by the time they get here, it wouldn't be worth the trip.
Good point.
There must be some other way to slip from one point in the universe to another, or from one universe to another. And in the book, we sort of touch on what's called transdimensional travel. And I know that's been covered by a lot of your guests. I've been entertained by it over the years,
uh-huh,
too. And I don't really have the math to explain it, but there, when you eliminate all the impossible, what is left is the answer.
How would you, if we were to travel this way, this is the one thing that always puzzled me, how do you know what black hole or wormhole you're going into and where you're going to come out of? Can you control that?
Sounds like it would take a lot of exploration and recording of what happened in order to have some kind of manual how to stay to one side or the other.
Right, exactly. Don't go through that wormhole. You're going to end up 10 zillion years away or something.
Yeah, and there are paradoxes and perturbances that we struggle with for years. We send vacuum fluctuations through a bridge, Einstein-Rosen bridge, formed from one point in the universe to the other, and the theory is that those are supported by neutron star material from the inside, But when we start to do the math, we find out that when we return before we left. And so the feedback, I guess it, you can call it, from that action actually destroys the wormhole before it's even formed. So what breakthrough we do in the book is we demonstrate that wormholes may actually be supported from the outside and not the inside by going through the center of these black holes. In that case, a wormhole can stay stable for hundreds of millions of years and be navigable by explorers who become skilled at doing this.
You do believe in extraterrestrial life out there?
I don't see how anybody can logically say that we are the only life form in the universe. And if you think about it and listen to the DNA map that we're uncovering, we may very well be the ET.
I've always believed that. It's kind of refreshing to hear you say that. I've believed that we've been seeded, maybe genetically altered, who knows what, but that we definitely came from above. And I also think what's important and refreshing about what you're saying, Brooks, is you believe in a creator.
Yes, we believe in intelligent design from a creator, and we try not to get involved in the religion of that.
I understand.
We sort of talk about all sides. The very first chapter of the book is called The Beginning, and it covers a little over two dozen major ancient texts from which, around which, each one, there's a religion built. And we try not to get involved in the religion, but we do acknowledge the ability for man to reach out beyond what he can sense with his five senses and receive this pure knowledge and write it down. Be he a prophet or a seer or a revelator or a remote viewer or whatever you want to call him, whatever divinity you assign to that person, his ability cannot be denied, his or her ability, and the history that they recorded, although it attempts to literally burn it out of existence, melt it out of existence, genocidically remove all those that believe it, it survives. And we now have it in the latter days, and we can put these things together and make sense out of it.
You know, because it seems to me that with these black holes, and they are real indeed, they're out there, that there was even a design for them. And, you know, when you begin to think about all this, I mean, it's truly magnificent. It really is. And to think of the architect who would think about all this, and I would assume not make a mistake, it's pretty dramatic.
Yes, in the introduction of the book, I make mention of that. I have a personal philosophy that everything we do will eventually affect the universe. I try to do that on purpose as often as I can. But one of the things that I've done is keep my family awake over the last 40 years, thinking about the tailor's workmanship about this universe. Mm-hmm. The more that I learn about it, the more mathematics that I master, the greater the order and intelligence, not the chaos and degradation and unmanageable patterns of confusion, but I see order, and I see purpose, and I see design. One of the most fascinating things that occurred last year, the Hubble telescope finished its mission of aging the universe, and they decided to do something different with it. They opened up the lens, and they pointed it into a relatively dark portion of the universe where nothing's readily visible, and they left the lens open for 8.3 days, and then they closed it. Then sometime later, maybe a week or two later, somebody said, hey, we need to go look at that that photograph that we took.
Yeah, that spot of black darkness, right?
Yeah. So they downloaded it, and as it was downloading, they sort of postulated among themselves, gee, we're looking into a very young part of the universe. Surely we'll see remnants of the Big Bang. We'll see chaos. We'll see clouds of gas coalescing into planets and galaxies. And then the picture came up, and it wasn't that at all. It was thousands and thousands of organized galaxies.
With billions and billions of stars in each galaxy.
Already organized.
Yeah.
In one of the youngest portions of the universe.
That you cannot see with the naked eye.
Right. Well, you can't even see with Hubble until you leave the lens open for a week.
That's pretty far. That's something. Well, with this order, with this creation, have you, and I don't want to jump ahead because we've got you for a few more hours, but have you come up with an understanding of why?
Yes, and I'll try not to jump too far ahead. Let me lay a little bit of groundwork. We talked about the flood earlier, and we asked why the flood? Why did all of this happen? But some records that we have say that the morality of the creation, the men that were here and there on the planet, had become corrupted, that the order, the maternal or paternal order that had been set up by the Creator had been corrupted. And we did some investigation as to who corrupted it, who brought corruption to the earth. And we found in Genesis a race known as the Nephilim. Now, there are lots and lots of books written about the Nephilim, but I think all of them missed the mark.
And when you're saying we found, you're talking about you as scientists or you as what?
As authors. Okay. my co-author, E.J. Clark, found evidence that the Nephilim were actually off-worlders. They were not human. They were giants. They were watchers that came to this earth, very, very intelligent giants, and they had children with men. It says in the scriptures that the sons of God and the daughters of men had offspring, and that offspring became corrupt. Now, one thing about the Nephilim's DNA, as opposed to our DNA, is it could blend with anything. It could have children with men. It could have children, offspring with any kind of animal. And so all of these anomalies, these aberrations became visible and became prevalent, and men wrote about them.
And in some cases, I would say hideous.
Yes. Right. Yeah, a lot of them were abominations. And the earth became so corrupted, so upside down, that the Creator decided to clean it with water, and so the flood occurred. Now, those Nephilim, being off-worlders and very intelligent, many of them left prior to the flood, and they were
in craft. I assume that they got here in,
or they transdimensionally travel somehow.
All right.
But they were present on both Earths, the spirit Earth and Noah's people, and this Earth here. And then after the flood, they returned, and they continued to corrupt this planet. And there's a record of them in the Atlantean writings, in Lemurian writings, all over South America. There are these creatures, and they are 7 feet, 8 feet, 9 feet, some of them 12 feet tall.
Do they look human?
Yes. Six fingers, six toes, multiple rows of teeth, huge skulls, huge jawbones, tremendous appetites, very intelligent, and obviously a lot stronger than men.
Yes.
And so men served them, and they manipulated kings and civilizations, and their mission was to thoroughly corrupt this planet, to make it unusable for something.
Why?
Because there was an event that was going to occur on this earth, and every world knew about it.
Except us, I guess.
No, we knew about it too. And it was recorded, going back as far as writing could be found. And that event would be the birth of the Son of God. They wanted to make the earth unsuitable for that birth.
Why?
I'm not really sure, other than that their mission was different than the Creator's mission. He has opposition in the universe.
I mean, could you call the Nephilim evil?
Yes, I would say evil, although as a scientist, I'm trying not to call things evil.
It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah. So there are a lot of people that believe that the Son of God was born here to be the Savior of all mankind, not on just this earth, but all worlds in the universe.
Right, it might have happened all over the place. Yeah.
And that the reason he was sent here is because this was the most wicked earth and would be the only one that would crucify him, when in actuality we make the claim in the book that it was the most unlikely earth.
Okay, so the Nephilim, they're here. they're trying to disrupt as much as they can. What happens? I mean, do they fight amongst each other?
Some of them do. They, because of lack of technology here, they couldn't do everything they wanted to do. So they commissioned a man and helped him to build edifices to false gods, lead them down false trails. They helped them build pyramids and Stonehenge and taught them about astrology and all kinds of mysticism and craft and murder and war and all of these things that have led us around and around and in a cycle of self-destruction. And everywhere you go, whether it's the pyramids in Egypt or the buildings, great temples in South America, you see these creatures. They're standing there. In Egyptian writings, you can see them with wings standing behind earthly kings with their hand on the shoulder of the king, sort of saying, you say the words, but I give the command.
Right, the puppet masters.
Sort of, yes. And they're everywhere. They're carved in stone. They're in paintings on paper or papyrus. They're carved, they're cast in clay. And this is the evidence that we found.
Are they hideous looking? But because I thought they looked like us.
They do look like us, only larger versions. Now, some of them are a little deformed. You can tell from their skull shapes or from the shapes of their bodies, they're slightly deformed compared to us. But this is because over generations, they go through the same genetic aberrations that we do. There were only 200 of them when they originally came.
So that's it.
As they, you know, continue to inbreed or their offspring inbreeds, then they become corrupt.
How do we know, you know, if you look at one of the old Superman movies, Brooks, how do we know that the 200 weren't like, you know, criminals from their own planet that they just shipped out and they ended up here?
I don't think we know anything about that other than we call them fallen. They at one time had glory. They had rule. They had scope. But they did not come here through any authority. They fell here, and they were able to take out, I guess, their revenge on the creation. So now we'll get back to the question as to why all this occurred. Why was the earth, why was all this energy expended to create an earth? And the reason is, and we try not to make this case too deeply in the book, because that's not the purpose of the book, but the reason is that God has a mission. He has children, which is us, and he wants his children to become, to reach their full potential. And we, it doesn't take much reasoning for a person to realize that if they're the offspring of God, what will they be when they grow up?
Let's talk more about some of this when we come back, Brooks. In addition, you've got your own take on the Mayan calendar. I've got to ask you about that. And also, were the bones of Adam and Eve reburied? And where? I'll be back.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com.